Let us train boys from earliest childhood to be patient when they suffer wrongs themselves, wrote St. John Chrysostom in the late 4th century A.D. But if they see another being wronged, to sally forth courageously and aid the sufferer in fitting measure. This is the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast on the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. How to raise children to be good and courageous adults is a perennial question. Our civilization requires good and courageous adults, and the Church requires good and courageous adults as well. Some 800 years before St. John Chrysostom, Plato and then Aristotle asked how we form boys into courageous young men. At June's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Professor Kyle Washit discussed what Plato and Aristotle had to say on the subject. Here is his lecture in its entirety.
So I've been remembering fondly, Barbara and I were both at the original Wyoming School of Catholic Thought back in 2003 up on Casper Mountain. I was the dishwasher. Oh, okay, you were the very first one here. Okay, all right, so not even the very first. Oh, I see. Lions Camp, that's right. Yeah, and at the very end of that, you know, we'd had Father Shawl and Deal Hudson, all these people giving great talks. And at the very end, the faculty go down to eat steaks at a ranch. And my dad and I are up there scrubbing the dorms. And dad looks over and he says, Kyle, you know, I was going to college at this point. He says, Kyle, remember this as you're making your life choices. Be the guy on faculty, not the guy scrubbing the toilets. So. However, in the history of the college, I have also been the guy scrubbing the toilet, so I'm not sure. But at the end of that encampment, Father Shawl wrote a reflection on his experience at Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, and he published it in Crisis, and he said, what I think was unique about this intellectual encampment was the emphasis that intelligence, music, art, work, worship, politics, good fellowship, and personal conversation all go together. Everyone needs to know of books and ideas that he had missed, not known, or forgotten. Attention to the mind, truth, and intelligence is itself a peculiarly Catholic thing, not to be neglected. Yet reflecting on this experience, this is most valuable of what I have learned. To be a man in Wyoming, you need to be able, without boasting, to ride a horse, shoot a rifle, fish, hunt elk, repair and drive a truck, build and rebuild a house, know how to drive in snowdrifts, wear a cowboy hat and western boots, dance in them, think, pray, speak softly, and as Saint Paul has said, obey your wife in all things. Now, aside from just a trip down memory lane for the first Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Father Shawl touches on this, on the question that when we come to Plato and Aristotle is fundamental for the question about courage, namely, what's it mean to form a man? As Jenny has pointed out to us, Andrea, the word that Plato uses to describe courage, Andrea comes from the Greek word for man, and so it's manliness. Okay? And so, in general, this Andrea, which we translate as courage, was seen as this manly virtue that is what built a civilization. Yeah, we saw with Glenn's talk that it was Achilles' courage that is what preserves the order, not just of earth, but of the gods in heaven. For Virgil, it is Aeneas' courage as he plunges the sword into Turnus that actually founds Rome. Emerson will note in his Concord hymn, by the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmer stood and fired the shot heard round the world. It's this courage, this manliness that makes the nation. And as Jenny referenced D-Day, you know, and the 40th anniversary of D-Day, Ronald Reagan gave his famous speech about those boys of Point Duho. These are the boys of Plan Duho. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. These are the heroes who helped end a war. It's this manliness, this idea of Andrea, however it is we're going to form people to be manly, that will be the formation that founds or preserves the city. And so whether it's Father Schall reflecting on Wyoming virtue for the man, or Homer, or Virgil, or even Plato, we're asking the same question, fundamentally a civic question. Okay? Now, when I say that, it's going to be worth making some distinctions that we already started touching on when we were talking about Stan's talk earlier. And that's the fact that with courage, we're dealing with a lot of different ideas all thrown into this one word. And Plato, in various of his dialogues, has Socrates make fun of the sophists who are overly nice about words and overly distinguish words to mean this or to mean that. But at the same time, Plato's very concerned with definition. And so the thing we want to keep in mind here is that we are not sort of artificially pulling words out of their context and making them mean something, but rather we're looking for certain ideas, certain truths about reality, and then we have to look at the words available to us and try to use one of those words as best we can, even though that word is going to fall short, perhaps, of the precision of the idea that we need to have. Now, why is that important? Well, because we are dealing with a lot of words in this question we have about courage. We've already touched on the Greek word Andrea, which isn't the only Greek word for being brave, right? Tharsos is going to be used more often by Homer. But you have this idea of being brave in some sense, but Plato takes up Andrea. That's the word he wants to use to define as this manliness. Now, Plato takes up that word because we're not sure, this idea of there are these sort of four virtues of being an aristocratic Athenian, that if we say them now, we have all sorts of baggage with them. But at the time, they were more like, you should be a manly person, smart, fair, and self-possessed. And that sort of general attitude, that's what it is to be a good person in the city. Manly, smart, self-possessed, and fair. Now, Plato then gets his hands on those words and tries to refine them and ultimately creates a tradition that's going to give us these four cardinal virtues of prudence, justice, temperance, and courage. Okay? But initially, they're just words to describe a generically good thing. Okay? And over the history, this generically good thing gets developed in different ways. Now, in my three talks, I'm going to try to hit on the three main ways this generic word of courage gets pulled down. In addition to the complication of trying to get precise about what we mean by this word with this idea, we have another complication. We've got three languages in between us, right? So we have Greeks talking about Andrea, which they're trying to make precise to talk about this thing in this particular way. That gets translated by Latin philosophers thinking about Andrea, and they translate it as fortitudo, but not always. When the Latins first start translating it, they translate it with another word to mean manly, which is virtus, which becomes the word for generic virtue. And then when they start translating among others, right, so with Greek, among other variety of words, they translate fortitudo, and they're translating iskuros, meaning strong and mighty, or they're translating tharsos, which has connotations of being courageous. And then we come to English, where we're talking about courage, which is coming from, as we noted last session, cor, for your heart, and agere, the act from the heart. And initially, that word's not necessarily a virtuous word. You can have a bad heart and act courageously, but because you have a bad heart, acting with your heart is not a compliment, right? But by the time we are now talking about it, the idea of talking about courage as something broader than the virtue of courage is a little bit unthinkable to us, I think, that courage has become linked with the virtue. We might more readily in English talk about brave as something that has a broader connotation. A brave animal. Do you feel brave today? The brave man. The brave villain. Various things along that line. Whereas courage, we've sort of refined to be only our virtue word. And that makes it hard for us to keep in mind all of the layers of meaning that are going on. In addition, as we'll talk about more next in my next class with Fortitudo, that's going to be a bit broader than some of the things that are going to fall under Aristotelian courage. We've got some broader connotations of if you're strong or you endure, that's going to have some slightly different sense than just simply Andrea, this kind of act that Aristotle's concerned with. So we got some complications, and I'll do my best as we're flying around all of these different languages and different understandings to keep in mind what we're doing. The thing that I think is going to help us most with that is a scheme that, we talked about Neoplatonists, that Plotinus crafts, that Aquinas takes up. And Plotinus makes a distinction between three kinds of courage. Plotinus talks about civic courage, he talks about purifying courage, and then he talks about divine courage. Well, and by courage, it's true for any of the virtues. We could talk about any of the virtues as a civic virtue, as a purifying virtue, and as a divine virtue. Now, what we mean there is the civic virtue. This is coming from a Neoplatonist take on things that Plato says in the Republic. The civic virtue is the virtue that's directed to preserving the city, the polis. And that's not, when we say that now, that sounds, we have various associations with China or USSR or various things about, oh, I live for the city, that means an oppressive state that is, you know, sucking the life out of me for the fatherland or something, right? And that's not what the Greeks are meaning when they're talking about a virtue for the city. Here they're talking about it being like the culmination of earthly life, is to live united for law, for justice, to have the goods of civilization that can only be had if you're sharing them. Right, you can't be some rustic nobody and have the goods of philosophy and reciting Homer. You've got to share that in a community. And so the civic virtue are the things that are protecting civilization. They're protecting the peak of human life. That becomes civic virtue. But as we'll note, already starting with the Apology, when Jenny starts talking about the Apology, and moving more when we get into the life of Antony, the idea that the peak of our existence is living for civilization on earth already starts to be doubted a bit by the philosophers, and certainly by the time we get to the Christians, there's this rethinking of what we're meaning. And then we want to talk about these virtues not insofar as they're preserving civilization, but insofar as they, in some sense, are preparing us for entering into this new mode of existence after death. Already with Antigone, we're touching on the question that's at the border of this, right? What are there certain virtues that pertain to leaving the bounds of earth? And then what are those virtues and how do we cultivate them? And those come to be purifying virtues. And Plotinus will give them the same names as he gave the civic virtues. We can talk about courage at the civic virtue, and we can talk about courage as a purifying virtue. But what it's doing is going to be very different. And then lastly, Plotinus asks, well, all of the virtues in the end are images or pictures of how God is in heaven. What does courage mean when it's said of God, when it's said of the life, once we've crossed beyond? Not the virtues that get us there, but the virtues that characterize us once we're there, the virtues around heaven. And Plotinus will talk about divine virtue. And really, I think T.S. Eliot, even though he's not following Plotinus explicitly, T.S. Eliot has divine virtue on his mind when he's talking about what's going on with Thomas Becket, Murder in the Cathedral. And we'll bring in the four quartets and some things to show that's what's going on. But he's talking about this other sense of virtue, what the virtue is once you're divine. So these are our three levels. Now this is, again, going to be difficult as we're trying to talk about. We say, well, what's courage? Well, what courage does when it's a civic virtue may be different than courage when it's purifying me for enter into eternal life. Those may be two different activities, both perfections, but two fundamentally different activities. Okay? Last distinction that we're going to hit is there's another thing that we think about with virtue, and this is the difference between courage as a particular virtue versus courage as a cardinal virtue. And here we have, again, Plato and the Stoics to blame for this distinction. Okay? The particular virtue is what we're going to be looking at with Aristotle today. The particular perfective virtue that is the preservation of civilization as we know it is going to be what Aristotle's describing in his account of courage. Aristotle does not have an account of what we will call the cardinal virtues. This idea of four hinge virtues that sort of cover and control and contain the activity and expression of all virtuous acts. That comes to be the Stoics. Now, they're getting that from Plato. We don't have to get into exactly how they're getting it from Plato. They're partly getting it from Plato just in passing to note. Plato sees three fundamental motivations in human action. The intellectual motivation, the desiring motivation, and the spirited motivation, the thematic motivation. And so they're saying, well, if those are the three fundamental motivations, then the cardinal virtues are going to control those motivations in every activity we do in life. So I'm never going to act as a perfect human being. I'm never going to act without spiritedness. I'm never going to act in a dejected way. The virtuous person is always going to act in a spirited way. In which case, if we're thinking about courage as controlling the spirited part, it becomes a cardinal virtue, a hinge virtue that expresses itself in any number of perfective activities I might do. So we'll talk about it taking courage to be virtuous and the various courageous moments to tell the truth or to stand by my convictions or to resist temptation. But there we're using what the Stoics are talking about, courage as a cardinal virtue, the controlling virtue that expresses the kind of spiritedness that's necessary for me to act rightly in any given situation. So we'll talk about that a little bit more as well. That's not what Aristotle's thinking about here. We'll talk about cardinal virtues tomorrow, but right now we're not talking about that. We're not talking about courage as a purifying virtue. We're not talking about courage as a divine virtue. We're only talking about courage as a particular perfecting civic virtue that is refining what we mean by being manly. That's what we're doing today. This is one of those, as I go through these various distinctions, at one point I was talking to my dad and I was trying to make various distinctions. He said, this is why they kill philosophers. But so before we jump in, I'm just going to take a quote from Plato, where he puts it on the mouth of Socrates. Socrates is in a conversation with Laches, and they've just made a number of the distinctions I've just made, maybe less clearly. We'll leave it to you decide who was being less clear. But they made a number of these distinctions. And Laches is feeling worn out and says, I'm not sure we're going to figure out what courage is, Socrates. And Socrates says, we ought to observe courage insofar as it demands us to endure. If you are willing, let us hold our ground in the search for what courage is, and let us endure, so that courage itself won't make fun of us for not searching for it courageously, if endurance is in fact what courage is after all. To which Laches says, I am ready not to give up, Socrates, though I'm not really accustomed to arguments of this kind. But an absolute desire for victory has seized me with respect to our conversations, and I am really getting annoyed at being unable to express what I think. I still think I know what courage is, but I have no idea why I can't tell you. So, for those of you that need some courage as we go forward, take Laches' thought. All right. So, focusing on civic courage, we want to frame the question the way Aristotle frames the question. And Aristotle frames the question following Plato's dialogue, The Laches. It's one of the early dialogues where Socrates gets together with a group of Greek individuals to talk about what exactly manliness is. Now, the people involved in the conversation are almost as interesting as the conversation itself, because we have gathered there a man named Lysimachus and Thucydides, who themselves, and Milesius, who themselves aren't interesting, but they're sons of really interesting men. Lysimachus is the son of Aristides, who was called Aristides the Just, and he was second in command at the Battle of Marathon. And Thucydides is a noble statesman that opposed Pericles. He may be related to the Thucydides that eventually comes to us as a historian, but he's the major opponent for Pericles. And Lysimachus and Milesius have gotten together, and they've called two other generals to take part in their conversation, namely Laches and Nicias, who are famous Athenian generals at the time. Nicias is going to, in fact, utterly fail to be a good general eventually, but that we'll leave that for a story when we talk about the Peloponnesian War. But they've come and they're trying to think about how they ought to be, how they ought to raise their sons to be manly. Because they realize when they're talking to their sons, they tell them all sorts of stories about their dads, because their dads were famous generals that did great things. And their sons say, well, Dad, what did you do? And there's an awkward silence. And they said, because our fathers were so busy being great, they forgot to teach us how to be great. So we want to know, Socrates, how are we supposed to teach our sons to be manly? For the sake of preserving the city. So the question of manliness and courage for Aristotle and Plato is a question of for preservation of the city and a question of how do we teach it. And they're having this conversation at this place where these guys are showing off armor fighting. They're like, well, if you teach your son how to fight in armor, then you'll make a manly son. And they're like, well, is that true? And so they have the question, so they ask Socrates, is this the best way that we can make manly sons, is teach them how to fight in armor? And so Socrates says, well, we need to really think about this carefully. And he takes us through a series of distinctions that Aristotle's going to go back over in the Nicomachean Ethics. So first, Socrates says, we need to realize that manliness fundamentally applies to the soul, not to the body. That just because the guy does tons of push-ups doesn't make him manly.
It doesn't.
I know. Sorry, Father. I was trying to slip that in while you were gone. There may be a connection, Aristotle notes. There may be a connection. But Socrates argues, no, that this is about the soul. And he goes, and really, if we're going to talk about what courage is, we need to talk about what all of virtue is. But that may be a little bit too much. But Aristotle is going to take up the challenge, talk about what all of virtue is, and then take up, first and foremost, the question of what courage is, as the exemplar of what all of virtue is. Or at least, the easiest one to understand, if not the exemplar. At least the easiest one to understand. Our best example. So then, Socrates says, well, I'm not concerned with the virtue that just makes me not retreat. This is Laches' first definition, right? Virtue is, or courage is when you stand and you don't give up your ground and you don't run away from the foe. And Socrates says, well, sometimes can a retreating be courageous? Laches like, yeah, maybe. He says, and if you were on a chariot, maybe you'd run backwards sometimes. That would be courageous. He goes, okay, maybe. He says, all right, so maybe I asked the question wrongly, Laches. I'm wanting a really, really broad understanding of what courage is. And he says this, I wished to inquire of you about not only those who are courageous in the heavy armed soldiery, but those who are in the cavalry and those who are in every form of warfare. Not only those in war, but those who are courageous in dangers at sea. Those who are courageous towards sickness, poverty, or even toward politics. And yet further, not only those who are courageous toward pains or fears, but also those who are terribly clever at fighting against desires or pleasures, whether remaining or turning around in retreat. All of these are courageous, Laches, and I want to know this too. Now note, when Aristotle starts the Nicomachean Ethics, he says, what does it mean to be courageous? And he says, well, it isn't every sort of fear. And he specifically rejects being on the sea in the storm, specifically regrets the fear of poverty or the fear of sickness. He says, no, those aren't what we're concerned with. The thing that makes you stand strong in the face of pleasure or in the face of desire. No. Those are not what we're looking for when we talk about courage. This question, the Stoics will say, this question that Socrates asks is a question about the cardinal virtue of courage. That manliness that undergirds all these different expressions of virtuous action. Whether in the face of poverty or in sickness or for pleasure or for pain or the rest. But that's not, Aristotle says, what is properly Andrea, what is specifically the particular virtue of Andrea. For Aristotle, we want to focus on, in fact, the man who faces dangers in warfare, the man who risks his life in war. That is the paradigm of the virtue we're talking about. All those other things may have something to do with courage, but they're not what Aristotle's concerned with. So Socrates is already said, no, Socrates, you're going too broad. But there's another series of definitions that are proposed in the Lakeys that are worth noting before we jump into the Ethics. The next definition we get is courage is defined as endurance of the soul. An endurance of the soul, which is where the quote that I read at the beginning of this about endure, stick it out, let's courageously look for courage. This endurance of the soul becomes what Lakeys thinks. If you're able to endure any challenge, that makes you courageous. And Socrates addresses that and says, well, that can't be the case because sometimes it'd be dumb to endure things, right? There was a movie when I was in junior high about guys that were trying to show how tough they were, and they laid out in their football suits in the middle of a highway to let the cars run over their legs to show how tough they were. I think that would be a case where Socrates would say, that's not the kind of endurance of soul that we want to describe as courageous. That's just dumb, okay? So foolish endurance doesn't fit, okay? So then, like he says, okay, fine, wise endurance of soul. Socrates says, okay, wise endurance of soul. Well, if it's wise endurance, who's more brave? The person who doesn't know how to shoot and gets in a gunfight? Or the expert marksman who gets in the gunfight? Right? Who is the most brave? Achilles when he's fighting some poor schmuck of a soldier? Or someone that doesn't run from Achilles, right, and tries to stand his ground and face him. Who of those is more brave? And Lakey says, okay, yeah, I guess in all of those cases, we'd say the unskilled person has some more bravery, has more of what we're looking for manliness. And so Socrates says, well, that's difficult then, because we just said wise endurance was what courage was. But now, when we say someone's exceptionally wise or skilled, we say that takes away from his courage. So that doesn't work either. So then Nicias, who's been pretty quiet this whole time, Nicias says, all right, I'm going to step in and answer this. It's interesting. In Plato's dialogue, Nicias is dead silent through the whole bit, which is, I think, partly a commentary on the fact that Nicias was maybe unduly quiet at times during political reflections for the Athenians during the Peloponnesian War. But he finally jumps in and says, I'm going to answer the question. And he says, courage is some kind of wisdom, namely knowledge of the fearful and the hopeful in war and in every kind of situation. Knowledge of the fearful and hopeful in war and every kind of situation. To which Socrates says, well, then wouldn't the most courageous person be the seer? The one who can predict the future and knows how this is going to turn out? Wouldn't that make him the most courageous? And Nicias says, no, because he only knows what will happen. He doesn't know whether it's desirable or not. Right? That the courageous person might know that even though this bad outcome comes, that's desirable for something else. So no, the seer is not courageous. And Socrates says, well, what about animals? Don't we say there's brave dogs and brave horses? And if you say it has to be wise understanding of, you know, things that are to be feared, then those things couldn't be brave. To which Nicias says, well, no, of course, those guys aren't brave. They're just rash. They're just acting blindly. That's not real courage. So then Socrates says, okay, well, then if we say all of that, who would know best what is to be feared or what is to be hoped? Wouldn't it be the person that's the expert at everything? Wouldn't that just be universal wisdom? The person who's universally wise, he would know what is most to be feared or what is most to be hoped for? And Nicias says, yes, I suppose that's right. And he goes, well, then we're not talking about a part of virtue anymore. We're talking about the whole virtue, and we're back to where we started. Okay. And that's where the dialogue ends, because Plato doesn't like to wrap anything up. All right. At least early Plato, definitely not. All right. So what we have here is a series of things that Aristotle, we're going to see, just picks up almost all of those questions verbatim and uses that as the structure for which he goes through thinking about the question of courage. What kind of things is courage afraid of? And we distinguish fear of death in battle from fear of poverty, fear of etc. How do we distinguish courage from generic virtue? How do we distinguish courage from wisdom? How do we distinguish courage from what animals have? How do we distinguish courage from skill or experience? How do we extinguish courage when you are acting out of ignorance, right, or unduly hopeful? And so in general, he takes this dialogue from the Laches as his blueprint for telling us what courage is. He doesn't take up where Plato talks about courage in other places, whether it's the Republic or where he touches on it in the Phaedrus or various other points. He stays away from it and only talks about the courage, at least in the context of the Ethics, in the context of this Laches dialogue, which is really interesting. And there he's just sort of answering these questions as if they're open questions. And he doesn't take on these places where, at times, Plato's hinting at something like a cardinal virtue. He doesn't bring that up at all. And he certainly doesn't talk about courage as this form of a third part of the soul, of what the scholastics will call the irascible. That's not how Aristotle talks about it either. He's really restricted here to what Laches says. Okay, so to get our mind fully around what Aristotle's doing, we need to talk about the first thing he does, which is distinguish courage from virtue in general. So let's just note some quick things that Aristotle is going to say about virtue in general. The way that's often we come across the translation of what Aristotle says about virtue is we talk about it as a habit. Now, the translation that both Ginny and I like to use by Joe Sachs, Joe Sachs is a little bit allergic to the idea of calling virtue a habit. And the reason he doesn't like it is because of all the associations we have with the word habit, right? I have the habit of brushing my teeth. I have the habit of pacing. I have the habit of chewing my nails, right? It's sort of this unconscious thing that kind of happens that may be good, may be neutral, but there's nothing great. There's nothing excellent about it. So instead, when Aristotle talks about it, he wants to talk about it being a kind of active having, right? I have this condition that I've cultivated and that just springs forward in excellence. Maybe the best analogy we could have is the professional piano player, right? Who is just, his fingers, so to speak, are just ripe to play at any point. And you put the keyboard in front of him and the song just explodes out and there's excellence dripping from his fingertips as he plays this beautiful sonata. And he is in control of his movements. He is conscious of his movements, but it is effortless and it is beautiful. That's the image that Aristotle says. When we talk about virtue, it's a disposition to act like the professional piano player. Completely in control of your motion, completely beautifully, and completely excellent. Okay? But there's a range of dispositions we could have, right? Dispositions for particular actions. And we need to be precise about saying what condition I have for what action, which is where Aristotle comes to think about courage. He wants to be very precise about what exactly is the disposition that I have for what exact action. Not just generic goodness. That's not enough to explain what I'm doing. Like a piano player, he's not simply musical, he's a pianist, right? The athlete's not simply an athlete, he's a professional quarterback. So too, when we're talking about the virtues, we're looking for the exact, the particular, the fundamental thing that really is going to make us excellent in this particular way. And so if I can find something else that would be done beyond courage, you say, okay, well, it's courageous to give money. Like, well, okay, you're risking poverty or something, but Aristotle says, no, that's not the virtue. It's not being courageous, that's being generous. There's another excellence that defines your generosity of giving money. It's courageous not to sleep with someone who's not your wife. No, that's not courageous, right? That is smart, but it's not. No, we're going to talk about that's self-possessed. That pertains to the virtue of temperance at some level, right? It's an excellence. So what is the excellence that springs, that courage enables you to enact effortlessly and beautifully? And Aristotle says the way we measure that is by looking for something, and he calls it the mean between two extremes. And this is a difficult phrase for us as we're trying to discern what this is. He goes, for every virtue, we're going to find the mean between the extremes. And so he wants to suggest that courage is the mean between rashness and cowardice. It's actually the mean between three things, but we'll leave that out for a moment. But rashness and cowardice. And temperance will be the mean between being gluttonous and being abstemious. And you go et cetera, et cetera. And so we can use this mean and extreme technique to find what's the precise act that we're proportioned to by this disposition, by this virtue. But the problem with the word mean when we say that is that we start to think of virtue being something that's always in moderation, not too much, not too little. Okay? I was at a conference once where someone said, just sort of dismissively, we can't trust Aristotle on virtue because some virtues are not means. Some virtues are not milquetoast. And it seems it's just a fundamental misread of Aristotle. Aristotle, when he says the virtue is in the mean, he doesn't mean the virtue is in being milquetoast. He means the virtue. Again, the virtue is defined by this excellence, the self-controlled excellence that expresses itself effortlessly. When we say the virtue is in the mean, it's a helpful range finder, so to speak, what we're talking about. It's not being overly confident, it's not being unconfident, but when we come to, it's not being cowardly, but when we come to think about courage, there's no limit to courage, as Aristotle will put it. There's no limit to being as virtuous as possible. So when we say virtues in the mean, we don't mean don't be too virtuous. Don't peek out early. You know, pace yourself. A little bit of courage now, a little bit of courage later, right? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about that as our helpful range finder to figure out what exactly are the vices that we're moderating and how extreme, how perfect in the pursuit of this one virtue can I be? All right, so that is our setting. Okay. But Aristotle then makes one further step and he says, all right, the mean's not a helpful way to define courage. It's a helpful way to find courage. But precisely because we're going to say, well, you know, it's what you do generally, it's misleading to think of the mean as the definition of courage. For Aristotle, the definition of any action is going to be its end, right? So what's the end for which courage acts? And that is where we get our definition at the very beginning, where we have it. He says, courage can be shown in situations that give scope for stout resistance or a glorious death. So that's the arena of courage are in situations that can give a glorious death or that you can do something about, that you can act. Endurance alone is not sufficient to make it courage, according to Aristotle. You've got to do something. Right? It doesn't make you a great pianist that you can sit through a beautiful piano concert with appreciation. What makes you a great pianist is that you can play the piano, right? It doesn't make you a courageous person that you can endure pain.
according to Aristotle, what makes you courageous is that in the enduring of pain, you do something glorious. And what is the glorious thing that you do? There at 68, Aristotle gives us our definition. The man who faces and fears the right things for the right reason and in the right way and at the right time is courageous. And the end of every activity is that which accords with the disposition corresponding to that activity. This is true of the courageous man. So the courageous man is he who does the right things for the right reasons in the right way and at the right time. And then he summarizes that a little bit more easily for us, the last sentence. Thus, it is for a right, and here's the word we're going to play with a little bit, right and noble motive that the courageous man faces danger and performs the actions appropriate to his courage. Jenny touched on this in her lecture. What noble is translating? It's translating the word kalos, which, again, in my Joe Sachs translation, is translated as the beautiful. So the end of courage is the beautiful thing. Doing the beautiful thing in the face of death is what we're going to define courage as. Now this, I'll circle back to Plato for a moment. Plato has this image of the soul being composed of three parts. The chariot driver with two horses. The one horse is the desiring part, the other horse is the spirited part. Both of those horses, according to Plato, both of those horses are seeking the beautiful. So when Aristotle defines courage as the doing the beautiful thing, he's going to distinguish it from the doing the beautiful thing that is to be in love, right? I'm in love. I love the beautiful thing, right? But that's because there's a field of flowers and I go prancing through the beautiful flowers and no problem. Courage is when, you know, there's like the army horde that's between me and the field of flowers, and to get to the field of flowers, I have to fight through the army horde. Now we have the beautiful thing that is properly courage. So courage is not so much the mean between cowardice and rashness for Aristotle. That helps us find it. But courage fundamentally is doing the beautiful thing in the face of death. And he says in battle. And why does he specify in battle? Because battle, again, is fundamentally a civic activity. Why are you in war? You're in war for your civilization. You're in war to preserve your city. What, like the Normandy, right? Why do they invade? For the sake of saving civilization, as Reagan will say, right? So that courage then becomes the beautiful thing you're doing is the beauty of your city, is the beauty of a well-ordered law and structured society where, you know, men can marry and raise children and sing songs and celebrate the banquet. Someone who's willing to die for that, that person is courageous. And what makes him courageous is that he sees that as beautiful and worthy of dying for. If he's a professional soldier, that's not what makes him courageous. It makes him skilled. That's good. Good. We'd like to have some professional soldiers to help us fight. But that's not what makes him courageous. Right? What made the boys on D-Day courageous wasn't they were so well trained, the best trained fighting force to ever hit the seven seas. No, it's because they saw the good, or so we say, like we like to say, they saw the good of freedom and were willing to die for it. Similarly then, an animal, while we might talk about a brave dog or a brave horse, they can never be brave in the way of seeing the beautiful, of falling in love with that peak of human existence. That could never be enough to be courageous, because the courageous man does it while seeing the beautiful, and himself is aware of the beautiful thing he does. And lastly, Aristotle will note, what then about this question of virtue? Because when we talk about the professional pianist, one of the things that makes a professional piano player versus someone who's training a piano is the professional piano player plays effortlessly, whereas someone who's learning piano laboriously forces himself through the notes. So we're saying courage is a virtue and excellence. The question comes, all right, well, is courage painful? Is courage unpleasant? Because if it's unpleasant, then it would seem that you're not actually acting virtuously. Because if you're acting virtuously, you're rejoicing in your ability to do this great activity. But if it's pleasant, then how are you being brave? Because if you're not scared and in pain, it doesn't seem like you're doing anything brave. And so Aristotle has to conclude his chapter with this question of, all right, how is the courageous man dealing with pleasure and pain? And Aristotle here makes the distinction. He says, what is pleasurable for the courageous man, what is beautiful for the courageous man, is both the beautiful thing that he sees that he wants to protect and the beauty of him protecting it. That is what's beautiful. The end of A Tale of Two Cities, right? I do now the most noble thing I have ever done. That I'm rejoicing in the goodness of my action. But the rejoicing in the goodness of my action doesn't take away from the fact that there's a lot of pain involved. And in fact, Aristotle says, I feel the most pain if I'm a properly courageous person, because my life I perceive as the most good. The sharing in the beauty of the city I see as one of the most beautiful things a human being can do, and to lose that I see as the loss of the greatest good a human can have. And when Odysseus meets Achilles in the shades, right? Achilles feels, having died, feels the loss of life. He asks about his son. He's yearning for the city, for the hearth, for those greatest things. And yet that he lost it is painful, but that he gave his life for it remains beautiful. And he would not have chosen otherwise for the sake of that.